Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for being here. I'm going to call the meeting to order today at 1:32. I'm going to turn it over to staff to begin the roll call.
Thank you. Sandy Mitchell, CPS. Thank you for your patience on everyone as we had to make some adjustments prior to the meeting, so I appreciate your patience as we did that. I just want to go over a few procedural reminders and changes that we're going to be implementing as we prepare for the hybrid virtual meeting option. So beginning this month, rather than using an all in favor voice vote, we will use a roll call vote. So each member's vote is clearly recorded for the record. When it's time to vote, I'll call each member's name and then on the yes, no, or abstain. A few additional reminders, please direct your comments through the chairwoman and wait to be recognized before speaking. And please turn on your microphone and get as close as possible to the mic when you're speaking. This ensures not only that the recording is clear and accurate, but it's also for the members of the public that are here with us today. So I'll start with a roll call and please say present when I call your name. Chairwoman Beth Goulden.
Present.
Ms. Amanda Atkins.
Present.
Mr. Blake Barney.
Present.
Dr. Brecken Blaze.
Present.
Ms. Colette Chapman.
Present.
Detective Ben Cook.
Present.
Mr. Ben Villarno.
Present.
Dr. Stephen Gray.
Present.
Mr. Jim Hanright.
Present.
Mr. Joseph Kelroy.
Present.
Ms. Katie Cretchy.
Present.
Dr. Kara Loki.
Present.
Supervisor Jeff McClurk.
Present.
Dr. Sheridan Miller.
Present.
Dr. Peter Maury.
Present.
Ms. Missy Music.
Present.
Mr. Scott Bailey.
Present.
Mr. Shane Neal.
Present.
Ms. Melanie Oppheim.
Present.
Mr. Nicholas Pulowski.
Present.
The Honorable Anna Young.
Present.
I'm sure we'll have 21 board members present. Excuse our Ms. Jamie Folsom, the Honorable Suzanne Cullen, Supervisor John Fanny, Major Frank Griego, Ms. Caroline Brzezowski, and Representative Kyle Powell.
Thank you. To start things off today, I'm going to address two items that were recently raised by the public, as it is imperative that we clear up all misconceptions. First, at no point has this board indicated that absolutely no recommendations will be made to the legislature during this legislative session. The matter discussed at our last meeting was with regard to making no recommendation on a specific general fund issue. That distinction is borne out by the recording of that meeting and transcript posted for the public review. Second, I speak to the legislature in two capacities. As chair of this board, when articulating positions that the board has formally adopted, and secondly, as a professional with more than 25 years of experience working in this field. Those roles are distinct, and I have been careful to maintain that distinction. To be clear, as of right now, the board has taken no formal positions on pending legislation. Thank you. I'm going to turn over to staff now for a call to the public.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For members of the public, before beginning your public comment, please state your name and your organization for the record. Verbal public comment will be limited to 3 minutes. A timer will sound to help speakers manage their time. When the time indicates that your time has expired, speakers are expected to promptly conclude their remarks. First up today is Tori Greaves. Tori here. Next is Suzanne Dodson, followed by Charles Dodson, followed by Sonia Jennings.
And Dawson. Last month, I shared my frustration that outside the courtroom, no one will distinguish between negligence and predation. My son accepted his probation for negligent child abuse as he admitted to having consensual sex with a girl, all the while unaware he was committing a crime. He was evaluated and found no substance abuse issues. For the last 5 years, he has not only maintained employment, he's building a career. His previous probation teams kept telling him that he's boring and not somebody that they're concerned about. The last team gave him permission to socialize with his friends, even go out and have a couple beers, just don't get in any trouble. He had no problem following their rules. The opportunity to gather with his friends did wonders for his mental health, which is not surprising because during COVID, we all learned how damaging isolation is. For making a better job and moving to the other side of town, he was given a new probation. They promptly removed the permission to socialize for the same reasons the other two teams said that he was low risk. He's been yanked back into isolation and not in this place. But the state says that he is not a sex offender. But they also insist that he attend weekly sex offender treatment meetings. Please recall last month when I told you that he tries to talk in therapy about his guilt and feelings that if he'd known their age, this would never have happened. And he's reprimanded for not taking responsibility or learning his lesson. His ABLE and other assessments found zero pedophile tendencies. These were done by Dr. Paul Simpson, expert in his field, with testimony for state, federal, and military cases. How can you treat a problem that doesn't exist if he has been found to have no tendencies? In my research, I found that court-ordered therapy should have goals, clear criteria for advancement, progress discussions. In short, you should know where you stand. That's not what's happening in this case. He has never been given a progress report. He has never been told what it looks like. He has no idea, or if his therapist even thinks that he's making any progress, he has no idea. In his new assignment, he is told to write 10 diary entries from the point of view of his victim. But all he knows about her is that she stole a bottle of gin and pretended to be 18 years old as a college freshman. When he questioned his therapist about the diary entries, he was told to make something up. Being told to write lies for 6 months is not therapy. The psychological damage goes beyond shame and loss of trust in the entire system. I hope that you all know and can see that there are legal and ethical risks to this. This is the limit to this file. Yes.
Thank you.
I would ask the public to please silence your phones. Cell phones with you, please. Next is Charles Dodson, followed by Sonia Jennings, followed by Patricia Borden.
Good afternoon. My name is Charles Dodson. That's my mom on to some question. Obviously, when I was 18, I was a freshman at ASU and had sexual contact with an underage girl who misrepresented herself. I was charged with criminal negligence and child abuse, and I was sentenced to 10 years of supervised probation with sex offender terms. One of these terms is to attend these mandatory, treatment meetings offered through a private treatment provider. And throughout my time in treatment, she mentioned it, but I have noticed a decent amount of inconsistencies and just observations that are awfully troubling to me. Being that there is a, preset curriculum that we are following in treatment, we're not made aware of what the lesson plan is, where we stand, how far we are moving through treatment. I'm in my fourth year right now, and it has been mentioned that there is an MSI test offered at the beginning, in the middle, and at the end of treatment. After 4 years in treatment, I still have not received a middle treatment MSI, nor have I been made aware of when that's going to be. I was told by my probation team that with my earned time credit on probation for being boring, my termination date would be in 2028, as long as I'm completely done with my treatment. So if the treatment takes 4 more years, it means that I although I've been following the rules, still will not have the opportunity to be off probation in 2 years. The provider has also administered these tests after insisting that the preliminary test I did with Dr. Simpson was not valid. And upon request to see the results of my MSI enable, I was declined, said no. On some assignments where I am asked to answer questions about how I justify my offense or discuss my victim's point of view, I am told to make something up when it does not apply to my offense. And that does come out as a lie, which then goes into my file, and then there's a non-truths in my file. I also am led to believe that when I mention anything about being under the impression that my victim was an adult, or about the fact that I was unaware that I was committing a crime, that I'm victim shaming, I'm shifting responsibility, and this has led to me once again having to, you know, make things up just to make it seem like I am proving when there really was not much to prove. I just want to understand how this program is really designed to help. I can understand that for some offenders it can make a difference. However, for people who, you know, ended up in this, who ended up in this who don't have tendencies for pedophilia, it seems like it's having the reverse effect. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next is Sonia Jennings, followed by Patricia Borden, followed by Fred Hedy.
Hi, my name is Sonia Jennings. I am operator of about 150 houses, sex offender housing, which is completely regular. So I'd like to say that I'm a big piece of the puzzle here. I'm from California and I came here, and you know, we have so many different problems. I didn't choose the problems to work with identity. Social work background. So this story that I just heard about, so it's something that I hear common. I'm here kind of to talk about the HB 2870, the homelessness, and I've been a frontline person for a very long time. I've been doing this work for 24 years, reacclimation, reentry from the prison system. I mean, if we were all judged by the mistake that we made, and if that not judged, but if we were defined by that one decision, I think we were obligated. So that gives me like a moral compass to meet each person where they are. It's not a cookie cutter solution. I can't change the laws. I can work as a pivotal person to help empower my community and help those affected by the laws. Also working hand in hand with the Department of Public Services. We work with the Sex Offender Registration, probation and parole department. So we have a very structured housing. There's counted, there's high accountability. I do not see success, a lot of success, and there is isolation. And I'm talking from our person on the outside looking in, but also someone looking up close in front. If these guys do not have the support they got, they have this problem. That they don't have the support, there's so much isolation. If we all support the encouragement, you know, the encouragement to go into treatment, to be honest, to be transparent. Treatment heals. Incarceration functions. So with treatment, I'm pro-treatment. And we can do that in a structured environment as being a piece of the puzzle and us coming together and really, you know, saying what is the solution to this problem or how can we help? I'd like to say that I've made an impact. HB 2870 is going to put a lot of people, close to 9,000 people homeless. I have older men that have done 25, 30 years. Family has died off. They're on ventilators. There is no one there. If I wasn't there, they'd be on the street and they definitely would not survive. So that's my stance on this. I didn't know that they have these meetings monthly. Thank God for Patricia and the ladies that I've talked to. You know, I'm glad to be a part of something and come with some community awareness. So thank you.
Thank you.
Patricia Borden, followed by Brad Hadid and then Dr. Gary Hardy.
Good Good afternoon. I'm Patricia Ford, founder and director of Arizona's Correctional Sex Offenders. I'm happy to say that my eyes are better, so I can read my statement unlike last time. We share the same values as the board: public safety, preventing sexual offenses, and evidence-based policy. It is in that spirit that we are here today. We want to bring something to the board's attention. SB 1585, as our chairwoman mentioned, was heard before the Senate Judiciary Committee on February 18th. It is not on your agenda today, and yet the legislation falls squarely between your mission. We believe it is important for this board to know that at that hearing, testimony was given in support of 1585. However, over 20 people registered their opposition through the request to speak. The public spoke clearly. This board deserves to know that and deserves the opportunity to formally, I say, weigh in with your established board and your established process. Senators on the committee also raised questions about whether this board had officially weighed in. This is a fair question, and the answer is that you have not had this opportunity. We also ask the board receives $400,000 in annual appropriations. What is the justification for an additional $200,000 surcharge to collect from court orders for people that don't have the money to pay? Several other states run their sex offender management board on appropriations, not on the money from people on the registry. We are asking you today to write to the legislature and the governor requesting that the SB 1585 be held until the board has formally reviewed it and provided your official recommendation through your established processes. The public has spoken. Now it's you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next is Fran Hadid, followed by Dr. Gary Hardy, and then Jennifer Hammer.
Good afternoon. Fran Hadid. So I'm probably one of the largest private investors that provides sex housing. Here to discuss how important it is for HB 2870 to come to light in front of this board, and for this board to be a little louder in front of the legislature in regards to denying such a bill to come to the next vote. As a housing provider, now I don't do any of these. I lease out properties to structured housing for sex offenders, so I'm not involved in the structure itself. But I can tell you the difference as this bill is presented, that they want sex offenders to all live individually versus community. I believe that would create a chaos in all cities, in all districts, that many people are uneducated about and don't realize what will happen. In my experience between providing housing for individuals and housing for structured houses, I believe that I am more content in providing opportunity for those houses in communal living much more than single. I personally walk away from every property that has a single sex offender living in there, concerned and worried about what can happen if this person not having an oversight by any other person, not having an oversight in his living domain by a house manager, by other sex offenders that are doing their best to make it through life, what can happen by this person living alone? There's a lot of mischievous acts that can occur while they're living alone. They have no oversight. For communal housing, thus, you have house managers, you have curfews, you have as soon as someone does not come home, you have house managers contacting parole officers, probation officers, even the managers of the structured housing itself. Where is this person? What time is he coming home? Is he at work? If he's not, let's find out where he is. So this HB 2870 is geared to eliminate communal housing and focus on single housing for individuals. And I believe that this board needs to have a louder vote. We've been in contact with some of the representatives, and they just told us that nobody's approached them regarding this matter. So please.
Thank you. Next is Dr. Gary Hardy, followed by Jennifer Hammer, and then Erica P.
Madam Chairman, members of the board, my name is Gary Hardy. I am currently supervised. I'm one supervisor in Mendocino, Arizona. I served 17 years in the Arizona Department of Corrections, where I worked as a literacy tutor, a GED tutor, and worked in the sex offender education treatment program for 6 years. While I was in there, I also became a certified paralegal, finished my master's degree, PhD, and wrote a book. My time is well spent and well invested. I'm coming today to express my opposition to HB 2870, as other people have. This bill, today's agenda, makes it unlawful for a level 2 or level 3 registered on supervised release to reside with any other registered individual unless related by blood, marriage, or adoption. While I understand the intent, there may be public safety, the likely effect is exactly the opposite. First of all, housing stability is one of the strongest predictions of successful supervision. Any probation officer will tell me that. Every evidence-based correctional framework, including risk-based, risk-need responsivity, and assistance research, identifies stable housing as a core protective factor. Individuals who are stably housed are easier to monitor, more likely to engage, remain compliant, and less likely to reoffend. Registered individuals already face extraordinary housing barriers, geographic exclusion zones, landlord refusal, zoning overlays, and financial limitations. Shared housing is often the only lawful, realistic option available. Removing that option will increase homelessness and transience. Homeless individuals are harder to supervise, harder to monitor, and more likely to incur technical violations. That does not enhance public safety. It weakens it. Second, Arizona already classifies residents based on risk and assigns notification levels accordingly, as Mr. Cook's going to talk about here in a little bit. Probation officers already have authority to deny unsafe housing arrangements. If two specific individuals living together present a legitimate risk, supervisors can address that on a case-by-case basis. HB 2870 replaces individualized professional judgment with a blanket prohibition. Evidence-based supervision depends on individual assessment, not categorical bans. Third, if this bill is applied to individuals already on supervised release, it raises serious constitutional concerns. It would criminalize living arrangements that are lawful at the time of sentencing and impose new disabilities retroactively. That invites litigation under ex post facto principles and increase the cost of the state.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next is Jennifer Hammer, followed by Erica P., and then Marina Fleetway.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and members of the board. My name is Jennifer Hammer. I'm the mother of someone on the registry and a concerned person regarding the age of 2870. I would like to highlight several reasons why this bill would become a problem for the citizens of Arizona and for people on the registry. It is already extremely difficult finding a place to live when a person is required to register due to the many restrictions they have. This bill would devastate and create homelessness for thousands of Arizonans who are working hard to rebuild their lives. It would close group homes that can be the last resort for countless people before they become homeless. The long-term ramifications will be severe and far-reaching, unleashing thousands of people into unknown living situations and neighborhoods. People on the registry who are under supervision receive regular unannounced visits from their officers, so they are closely monitored. Registered people under supervision need to take regular polygraph tests and consistently pass them. They have mandatory counseling sessions upon release from prison that will be much harder to monitor if they are living on the streets without adequate transportation or accountability. Homelessness creates despair, and the loss of hope could increase crime. This directly goes against Katie Hobbs' 2030 plan that is in place to help people released from prison successfully integrate into society. This could cause strong concerns for the people of Arizona as they watch thousands of registered people go onto the streets and into various areas. My son co-owns his home with one of his roommates, and they are both on the deed. The three of them who live there have stable employment at the same company, maintain their home with pride, and get along well with their neighbors. They met at a Christian group home and live clean and godly lives. Passing this bill would mean that two of them would have to leave and become homeless. HB 2870 would create chaos and uncertainty for thousands of people and create a huge burden on the people who supervise them. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Erica. Marina Fleetwood, followed by Darren Stanley.
Good afternoon. My name is Marina Fleetwood. I'm deeply concerned about the direction of so-called reform in Arizona, reform that increasingly means more restrictions. Though labeled regulatory rather than punitive, for those living under these policies, believe me, it's punitive. This legislative session alone, numerous bills have been introduced that expand restrictions rather than promote stability, rehabilitation, or public safety. HB 2870, which limits multiple registrants in one household, is a clear example. Support for this bill has been driven by political motive, as most know, by a representative running for chamber mayor and motivated by fear, not evidence. If enacted, it will force registrants into homelessness. When people lose stable housing, they lose jobs. And when someone's in crisis over where they sleep, even minor reporting deadlines can be missed and is a failure to register. That leads us to SB 1239, which would eliminate the statute of limitations for failure to register charges. Failure to register is often portrayed as an absconding, but in most cases, it involved technical or administrative issues, clerical delays, timing errors. When asked directly, Senator Schamp confirmed that measure was recommended by this board at the request of DPS, despite already extensive reporting requirements. If that wasn't enough, HB 2413 proposes GPS monitoring for those registrants who are now homeless. And how are we going to fund all of this? Well, that takes us to SB 1585. Expanding the funding for monitoring by increasing the financial penalties for sexual offense convictions, heavier burdens on people who already may be homeless, unemployed, or in severe distress. Together, these proposals mean more restrictions, more surveillance, fewer paths to rehabilitation, cost the state millions, and offer little but proven public safety. Arizona has become an outlier in sex offense policy. New requirements create more opportunities for technical violations, more public fear, and more instability. My husband is 80 years old with an old conviction for an attempted DCAC offense. He served his sentence and had been fully compliant for the last 40 years. As a level one research shows, his likelihood of reoffending at his age is less than 1%, the same as any male on this board. If a person could live lawfully for 40 years and still be treated as if nothing has changed, then what's the purpose of rehabilitation? If punishment never ends, can we call it justice? 40 years of compliance, 40 years of proving day after day that people can change, grow, and live lawfully. And yet, every legislative session, we hold our breath. What new restrictions will be added? Yes, court challenges have stated these restrictions are not punitive. Yet, Senator Schamm herself once stated her goal is to make every sex offender's life a living nightmare. Isn't that punitive? If 40 years of doing everything right is still not enough, then this system is not about public safety or rehabilitation. It's about permanent punishment. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, Darren Stanley.
Hello, and good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman and Board. Unfortunately, today I'm underdressed than I usually appear and unprepared as well. I had meetings this morning. I just wanted to mostly bring up SB 1092, which is where if you're a DCAC, we'll never give up probation. So I don't understand where we're going with this. It's just, why do I do everything that I'm supposed to do, go to therapy, complete my therapy? I never missed a single day of therapy and completed it in about 22 months. I just don't understand why everything needs to be punitive all the time in the state. 1404 passed, SB 1404 passed, up on level one. But I do have a DCAC, and in my sentencing, it clearly says non-dangerous and non-repetitive. So I think this label is overused many, many times. And 1404, I was after November 28th, I was got my flyer in the mail, and all my neighbors got my flyer. I was, I won't say popular in my neighborhood, but I'm a pretty handy guy, and my neighbors would borrow my truck, ask to use a tool. Some, you know, always say hello. Since November 28th, not one single neighbor has greeted me, asked to borrow anything, or had anything to do with me. My sister's lived in that all set 22 years. Thank God I have my sister back me up. All of a sudden, they're talking about housing. I have my sister, and I'm so thankful for that. And I have a great trade. I'm a union electrician. And I can always sign the books and go to work, and I don't have to worry about that either. But most of the people I'm around, people that I know that are level ones, DCAC, same thing. Not dangerous, not repetitive, but yet we're constantly being targeted. So thank you for your time. Thank you for listening to this. Again, I apologize for not being prepared. I didn't result enough because one of my terms of my reinstatement of probation that I did 3.5 years wrongfully and was released from the appellate court was probation didn't want me to have any computer access, and I'm still 3.5 years into that now with no computer access. Thank you, everyone, for your time.
Thank you. I also just want to address, please, no clapping or cheering from the audience. You will be asked to leave. Thank you.
We call Tori Reeves. A few people come in since I called her. And Erica P. I'm going to put the call to the public.
Here. Do I have a motion to go into executive session?
I need to move that we enter into executive session.
Do I have a second?
I'm going to add this second.
Thank you. At this time, we will convene into executive session if anyone from the public can. Going to the hallway, but we will come get you at the time we need to be. Thank you. And please take all your belongings. Do I have a motion to return for the next session?
Good morning, second. Oh, I'm sorry. A motion. Sorry, Peter Moore, motion to give the floor. I'll second.
I'd like to call for a vote on motion before us to return. I got a verbal, and all those in favor of returning from the session. Any opposed? Any abstaining? The motion passes. We're returning from exec session. Major Mitchell, can you give us a virtual meeting update, please? I'm trying for this. We will be offering a virtual meeting option in March for the March meeting. For board members, if you'll be participating virtually, we would ask that you let staff know via the ACS email as soon as possible. You will receive an individual Teams premium meeting invite with the link. And it should be for each board member. It can be used on up to 3 devices where you can sign in. So then on the day of the meeting, you would just locate that link, sign in either through the Teams app or through a web browser. I would ask that you log in 10 to 15 minutes early just to work through any issues that you might have or activity problems. And if you have difficulties, I'll include my cell phone number in the meeting invite. I'll be here doing all the things in this room as well, but just call me on cell phone and we'll get you the staff to help you walk through the login of that. We request that during the meeting, and we'll send instructions out when we send you the virtual link, but we would ask that you keep your camera on during the meeting. And you will be able to move to and unmute yourself as board members. We would ask that you raise your hand to request to speak. Cheryl will call upon you and make sure you unmute. She calls on you so that we can hear you. There will be no chat for the public or for board members. That chat feature will be turned off. The link on the meeting agenda is for the public only. They have different access. Their cameras cannot be turned on. They cannot unmute unless we call upon them to respond in the call to the public. So we would encourage you not to use that. Problems. And then I already talked about procedural changes that we need to make. So sure that board members that are participating virtually and those that are in person are their goals are accurately accounted for the goal policy method. So that is the update. I know many of you are looking forward to that virtual option, and please let us know ahead of time so that we can manage the virtual in person.
I do want to add, I will be here in person. I do encourage as many board members as possible if you're able to attend. Thank you, and thank you for working on this class. Next, we're going to move into subcommittee reports. Dr. Blakes, you want to start with the adult subcommittee?
So, the adult subcommittee has met 2 times since our last larger board meeting, and essentially we decided to sort of begin chronologically with the pre-sentence time frame, as we thought that was kind of the first touch point. So we did some research to capture what other SOME boards are doing in other states, and at that early stage where they're potentially initially looking at treatment needs, risks, kind of evaluating individuals. So we began collecting and sharing that information with each other. We have another meeting scheduled in March, and so we'll kind of shift into assessing how that information then is relevant for our processes in Arizona, and so it's formulating recommendations and ready to go next from there.
Thank you, Mr. Negri, with the juvenile subcommittee update.
Thank you. Pardon me. Similarly to the adult subcommittee, we've had 2 meetings as well. We, like the neighbors, started to review other states' protocols for pre-sentence part of the process as it relates to juveniles in the adjudication process. And we also talked about continuing to gather additional information from other states and also from our brothers and sisters north of the border, who have done an immense amount of research, that being the Canadians. We've done an amazing amount of research with respect to these issues in assessment capacity, treatment capacity, and a supervision capacity. We had a lively discussion last time. Things came up, particularly around the use of polygraph in juveniles, and we'll have a whole bunch more to say about that as we move forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next on the agenda is the legislative budget recommendation update. That was the letter that I signed from the board that you would not be making any recommendations on the budget at this time for this session. Moving into pending legislation, this is the time for the board to vote on whether or not we're going to discuss the three bills listed on the agenda. Do I have a motion?
I motion that we vote as to whether we should discuss the bills this year.
Do I have a second?
Second, Matt.
Can I call for a, or can you make sure to do a roll call vote?
Actually, at this point, I'm not sure this is on the committee. Do you have a discussion on that motion? So just to be clear, and iterate, at this point, the statute that this board together, we're not tasked with providing input on pending legislation that might be right to them. You are. So this would, the effect of having this conversation and voting would be to alter what the legislature tasks with originally.
As of today, that's correct.
And right now, though, there is a bill pending that would be asking us to weigh in on legislation.
The pending bill is 1585, and it makes it, it actually adds a sentence or two that makes it very clear when asked, this board will weigh in on pending legislation. But again, that it's not the law as it stands at this moment.
And did anyone look at the website of intent of the statute that created this board to see whether there was any conversation about that one about any less provided when I was eligible?
I did look. I didn't find much, but Madam Chair, if you would like to weigh in on the legislative intent.
I would like to weigh in on legislative intent. I think the legislature intended to hear from the Sex Offender Management Board on sex offender related issues. My concern was not weighing in as a board, even though I know we are tasked with a large amount of things to do. My concern would be bills with unintended consequences being passed and then this board having to possibly go back and undo, redo. And some of the boards today have serious implications for people. And their styles. That's my opinion.
I'd just like to make a comment on hearing these. I can if given more time and maybe another time, I can give you guys examples of numerous laws dealing with sex offenders that were poorly written. So our opportunity to voice now would save a lot of trouble, at least not mine. I deal with every day.
Here for it, I'd like to make this fortune also. And part of what I'm concerned about would be unintended consequences. A lot of all of this is coming as really fast. And I think if we don't, comment or vote on it now with things coming at us, and at least take it in and analyze it and give some comment on it, we risk becoming irrelevant as more and more self-pass things by. So I think from us taking out our territory and being what we were proposed and legislatively intended to be, we must have a duty to take in and consider these.
In rereading this statute, I did come across it is number 12, and I just came across this. And I will say, in working on this legislation over the past few years, I will reiterate, Arizona currently has no uniform standards for anything that we do. And the Sergeant Cook's position, there are bills every year that might have good intent behind them, but how they are practically applicated for the people that do the work, it doesn't work. So number 12, and I don't know what subsection it was, I did. This board is tasked with research, analyze, and make recommendations that reflect best practices for living arrangements for and the location of adult sex centers within the community, including shared living arrangements. At a minimum, the board shall consider the safety issues raised by the location of adult sex center residences, especially in proximity to public or private schools and childcare facilities, and public notification of the location of adult sex center residences. The board shall make recommendations for the adoption and revision as appropriate of the guidelines as it deems appropriate regarding the living arrangements for and location of adult sex centers and adult sex center housing. So I do want to point out the board has been tasked to look at housing. And I believe it's our duty to take on these issues, and I do look forward to discussing it today. Do you have something further comment before?
I have further comments as well. I support the recommendation from the chairwoman that we should discuss these bills. I know maybe not everyone is up to speed on the bills, being a relatively new board, but I think even the proposed legislation, we're only going to be tasked with kind of consulting and making recommendations on proposed legislation. It doesn't allow us to necessarily propose legislation. So if these bills pass that we otherwise would not support and have consequences, and we are a board made up of many professionals who work in this area, we don't make a recommendation, there's not really a mechanism for us to undo potentially bad law.
At this time, I'd like to move to vote. Can I do a roll to call? Call for a vote.
The motion did pass. It was the first. Who was the first? You, and then who was the second?
Peter Morgan, second.
I was asking who already made it.
It was Scott.
Scott. Okay, that's what I thought. Right, so now we'll do the roll call voting. Carolyn Golden?
Yes.
I just want you to repeat the motion for so we know exactly.
We are voting on whether or not the board is going to discuss the bills on the agenda today.
Ms. Atkins?
Yes.
Mr. Varney?
Yes.
Dr. Blades?
Yes.
Ms. Chapman?
Yes.
Detective Cook?
Yes.
Mr. Delano?
Yes.
Dr. Gray?
Yes.
Mr. Hanratty?
Abstaining.
Mr. Kilroy?
Abstain.
Ms. Krejci?
Yes.
Dr. Lucky?
Abstain.
Supervisor McClure?
Yes.
Dr. Miller?
Yes.
Dr. Maury?
Yes.
Ms. Music?
Yes.
Mr. Nagley?
Yes.
Mr. Neal?
Yes.
Ms. Opein?
Yes.
Mr. Pulaski?
Abstain.
Judge Young?
Abstain.
I don't care, that's 16 yeses, no nays, and 5 abstain. Motion passes.
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. The first bill I'm gonna open up the discussion on is HB 2870. Next up, pass out some guidelines for how we're going to manage the discussion, including some guidelines and whatnot. May I read the proposed legislation right now while we pass it out? Would that be okay to do?
that have not read the proposed legislation, does that mean a section in ARS 1337-27, which is related to unlawful residency, person convicted of criminal offenses. So, I mean, a paragraph, it is unlawful for a person who is required to register pursuant to section 13-3821, who is classified as level 2 or 3 offender pursuant to section 13-3825, and who is on probation or community supervision to reside with another person, who is required to register pursuant to section 13-3821. This subsection does not apply if the persons are legally related by blood, marriage, or adoption. Andrew Mitchell, did you want to go over what we
passed out? Yes, Madam Chair. So what we passed out is our proposed recommendation for how the board have the discussions on the legislation. The goal is just to ensure a fair, structured, efficient discussion of the proposed legislation within a lot of time period. So our recommendation is that round one, we have an initial deliberation of 15 minutes, on the chair we can introduce the bill, provide an overview, and then board members can have discussion. At the conclusion of the 15 minutes, we recommend that the chair would then call for a vote. On that first vote, the members would vote on one of the following positions: either support the bill, oppose the bill, or take no action. And that decision would be based on a simple majority of the members. If a majority is not reached, we would recommend that we have a round two of an additional 15 minutes of deliberation, and then a second round of discussions would occur. Focusing on the unresolved concerns or clarifications with an attempt to reach consensus. At the conclusion of that second period of discussion, the chair would call for a second vote. Again, the voting would be support, oppose, or conclusion. A majority would be required. And if it's still not reached after the two votes, the two rounds of discussion, recommend that it will be tabled, and then it could be reconsidered at the next scheduled meeting, as long as it's placed on the next meeting's agenda. Questions, no, I do not.
At this time, I'll open up for discussion amongst our members. Just as a key question, I would recommend for HB 2870 that we oppose this legislation, making people who live in the same residence and who are required to register not be left over the same residence. And we heard members of the public tell us about these shared living spaces. In my professional experience as well as a public defender, these are often the only housing arrangement that people can reside in who have to register. The collateral consequences of people being unhoused, the collateral consequences of that potentially increases the risk to the people. So, for those reasons, I would oppose this legislation.
Madam Chair, I want to understand why this was added to this legislation. Well intentioned people make bad law, I get that. I'm trying to understand why someone would put that in there, what purpose is it served, or is trying to solve. There it doesn't solve a whole lot.
Thank you, gentlemen. Procedurally, I believe we have both on these. If I just look okay, so I don't need to have a discussion, but can I have a motion to adopt the rules?
A motion, President Bates, a motion to adopt the rules.
Do I have a second?
Peter Morgan, second.
All those in favor, please say aye. Any opposed? And abstain. Thank you. Thank you. I also think it'd be useful, and maybe Mr. Neal can help with this, on a background on residency and housing issues, especially in our county. So, because I think the historical that's important. So, over years and time, CAS, Shelter Downtown, used to allow those out of DOC or almost registered sex special there. And that was lost many years ago. In the East Valley, there was East Valley Men's Center that would house individuals that were out of prison or homeless and attempting to get back on their feet and find a job. And that was eliminated as well. Apartments are typically crime-free housing. So apartments, anyone who registers is not typically permitted to rent an apartment. When you're out of prison or you just begin probation, you are typically not allowed to live with your family members. So family members are also off the table because oftentimes there are minors that live in there. A number of years ago, there were individuals that would purchase single family homes and turn them into transitional houses for those getting out of prison or who were displaced because they cannot live with their minor children. So it is my opinion that continuing to make further restrictions does not benefit public safety, nor does it speak to rehabilitation. And I don't know, Mr. Neal, if you want to chime in if I forgot anything, but I do think that history of this is really important in continuing to have restrictions I'm concerned with.
Yes. I mean, first I would say, my comments in here are always going to be, but that being said, for people to rehabilitate, housing is one of the first things that probation or parole or anybody focuses on to get stable and focus on everything else. So if you don't have the basic stuff, you can't do anything treatment wise or anything. So housing was one of the first things that we worked on. And as she just outlined, there's always been limited resources, but nowadays there's even less because even if you're in downtown Phoenix, places that used to be low income housing, it would take felons or, you know, people with bad backgrounds or whatever. But the places are all gone, they're all high rises now. So those places are gone. All the shelters, including EBMC and CAS and Phoenix Rescue Mission, to keep their federal funding, those are not options either. So different individuals that probation has a good relationship with, as does parole, for different transitional housing, so reentry. Generically, I mean, should a lot of sex offenders reside together forever? No. Transitionally, absolutely. So the plan in a lot of cases was a fixed period of time so they get stable, save up money to get their own apartment, maybe buy a house, just like everybody else. There are even guys on fixed income that are very elderly or veterans, because usually at the VA, they can't, they're not eligible for housing there either. They can go there for services, same with CAS, but they can't actually reside there. And also, I think it's noteworthy that this is statewide legislation. So I feel like what the original purpose brought forward was born from was, you know, some bad situation, a specific house in a specific neighborhood, a specific city, and that can be handled at the local level. So I would say either, you know, there's city ordinances that have come and gone, Phoenix ordinance have expired, but Phoenix have done some stuff. You know, Maricopa County to county can do stuff, and different counties and cities have different needs. So they can handle that at the local level. So if we here in Phoenix are making decisions, you know, I don't think we're always thinking about a rural county or an outlying county where, you know, maybe somebody has 20 acres and they have three guys within little outbuildings and they're, you know, working in crops or something like that. So, but they have the same address. So even in that scenario, they wouldn't be able to reside together. So there are definitely reasons why this should really be left to, because as it's outlined, these people are already on probation or parole, some protective supervision. So it's already in their probation conditions to approve or disapprove a resident. So they do that every day.
And there are times when it's appropriate, and there's times when it's not appropriate. So the supervising PO or even their supervisor, if you feel it out or whatever, they make those decisions all the time. So there are guys that are healthy, that are doing well in treatment and are good influence on each other. And sometimes there's, you know, they ask to resign with somebody that's not doing well, and we'll just tell them, no, that person's not doing well, they will drag you down. So it should just be a case-by-case basis. It doesn't need to be a statewide thing, and it should be at a local level. So if it was born out of the city of Chandler and they have an issue with Chandler, then, you know, there's ways, zoning or even HOA is where they can cover all that stuff.
Peter Morgan, I'm probably going to say the obvious, so I don't think that. So I want to pretty much agree with everything that Lee has said and the observations that Sheriff Moulton are mandate. And finding treatment and effective programs for sex offenders that we've been tasked to do, one of the major pillars in any treatment program we look at is health. And so this is working against what we are trying to accomplish here. So I think, as I stated earlier about, definitely should talk about it, I think that we should also oppose him and then do make ourselves harder. So I vote those, obviously.
Madam Chair, Scott Nagle here. My brain's going about five different planes right now, but I think the most important two are the following. The first one is, and I would be remiss if I didn't say this out loud, these laws came into effect not driven by research in the first place. They came into effect because of some really heinous and ugly cases that happened around the country. And we've been trying to figure out how to implement them in a way that actually does enhance and improve community safety, but they weren't born because we had research driving the need for them, the research and whether or not they actually do make the community safer. I won't profess to be an expert in what the research says about community notification, but as I understand it, we don't have any research that suggests that it actually makes the community safer, except for the highest risk guys. Seems that there's something to be said for the highest risk guys and knowing who they are and where they are and what they're doing probably has relevance. But there's still, to my way of thinking, if somebody knows something that I don't, I definitely want to hear it. And there's still very little research on whether or not the implementation of the registration laws has actually increased community safety. That's the first thing. And given that I'm the chair of the juvenile subcommittee, I would also be remiss if I did not articulate that this has implications for juveniles that have to register. Juveniles who we know collectively as a group that go through treatment and are successful in treatment commit sex offenses at very low rates after they've successfully completed treatment. This has implications for those juveniles that are required to register. But if I go back to the other issue about whether or not registration actually makes the community safer, and now we're having juveniles register, and the majority of them are probably not going to recidivate. Most of the long-term studies that I've seen shows recidivism rates for successfully completed juveniles in treatment are less than 10%. So I think that the data tells us some really important things about all of what we're having a discussion about.
Sergeant Coffey.
Sorry, I just want, I think I'm going the same direction everybody else is, but I give actual knowledge. First, only about a third of the people on the registry are on probation. The other two thirds have no regulation. I do have multiple house that house multiple offenders in the same residence. And what I've seen is that they actually work together, encourage each other, and remain more compliant than lone registrants do overall. The ones that we've seen have been 100% compliant. They give each other rides and encourage each other to stay within regulations. So, just my thought.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, it's, in my experience working with clients who are releasing from prison, we have faced a lot of barriers over time. I will note that Maricopa County, we used to have a cluster requirements that they were more than one for every 10 houses. And I feel like if that had been effective, they would have kept that policy. I think this has a lot of unintended consequences. I think it's been to our system.
I just want to add to that, that we're talking about that we are focused on this board. And on top of that, people I focus on it every day at the IDD planning as far as that this would have a negative effect on those who need extra support, living in group homes and so on. They may be living together and need that extra support because of their issues around development disabilities. So it's really totally.
Sure.
Online,
just touching base on the juvenile perspective too, when for offending the juveniles, the decision about whether or not to have them registered sexually, which a lot of times they very close to proximity, they're each probate, but they're going to be off probation. And I can tell you that out of the 13 years that I've been doing juvenile cases, a lot of those kids have not been moving to probation. That's their only option as far as possible.
Yes, I just wanted to echo some of the concerns regarding the unintended consequences of this legislation that not only affects group homes, but also potential halfway houses, nursing homes, and assisted living facilities. I don't think those were taken into consideration with our aging populations and our depression.
Sheridan Miller.
I'm Jill Pilgrim. Coming from Illinois with 30 years there, they are currently on the juvenile side trying to dig out of the hole. So I do agree with everything that's been said here so far. I think there would be unintended consequences. I believe we have states in this country that have chaos on their hands. As of this, I would support.
Yes, I can.
Sorry, can I be more on my phone?
Yeah.
And I'll get into it because my frequently charged juveniles are supposed to be excluded from the lending system. They should not get a level one juvenile.
Any other comment before I ask my motion to carry the vote?
Yes, correctly. I would just add, as we've all said, that housing stable residents, as we know, is related to risk of recidivism, and this portion of the bill represents a really significant reduction in viable housing options for individuals.
Scott Nagle, can I pose a question, perhaps, Ms. Gretchy? I'm listening to what Sergeant Cook said regarding juveniles being required to register. Operationally, I'm not sure whether that's accurate or not.
This is Katie Fetchy. I think maybe they're not supposed to have the notification that he's saying, but I definitely have clients that offended the juveniles that are. Well, 2 or 3.
Scott, we thank you for that clarification.
That concludes our 15 minutes of discussion. At this time, I'd like to ask for a motion to vote.
This is Katie Cretchy. I would move that we oppose HB 2870.
Do I have a second?
Yeah, I'll move around a second.
I'd like to ask for a roll call vote. Chairman Golden? Yes.
Yes, I vote to
the vote. Mr. Harney?
Yes, I vote to the votes.
Dr. Blades? Votes.
Yes.
You opposed?
Yes.
Thank you.
Ms. Chapman?
Yes.
Detective Cook?
Yes.
Mr. Galerno?
Yes.
Dr. Gray?
Yes.
Mr. Van Ratty?
I'm staying.
Mr. Kelbrick?
Yes.
Ms. Krejci?
Yes.
Dr. Milkey?
Yes.
Supervisor LaFleur?
Yes.
Dr. Miller?
Yes.
Mr. Maury?
Yes.
Ms. Music?
Yes.
Mr. Negley?
Yes.
Mr. Neal?
Yes.
Ms. Alpine?
Yes.
Mr. Palowski?
I'm staying.
And Judge Young?
Yes.
Madam Chair, the motion passes with 19 yeses, no nays, and 2 abstain.
Thank you. Moving on to the next 2 bills, which I think are very similar in nature, SB 1829 and HB 2966. Before we move into those, we have to ask Ms. Ballner to discuss what a dangerous crime against children 13-705 is. Thank you.
You're welcome, Madam Chair. I'm ready to give you a quick word. And I'm reading from what the Senate fact sheet uses. Dangerous crimes against children, also known as DCAC, include various crimes and sex offenses committed against a minor who is under 15 years old, including second-degree murder, aggravated assault, sexual assault, sexual conduct with a minor, sexual abuse, sex trafficking, luring of a minor for sexual exploitation, and aggravated luring for sexual exploitation. That is not the entire list, but it's the group that pops up most often. When you hear DCAC, the first thing that should pop into your mind is that the victim was younger than 15. So I understand the way Maricopa County and admittedly the AG's office prepares their pleas. We always include a reference, assuming it's true, to non-dangerous, non-repetitive offense. That should not be conflated with whether the plea includes a DCAC tale. Non-dangerous, non-repetitive refers to 13-704 and 13-703. So on its face, it's a little confusing, but DCAC is a sentence enhancer in a nutshell. I think that covers it, Madam Chair. Should I ask for questions or? The reason it's relevant is these 2 remaining bills are focusing on those people who do have a DCAC designation in their plea or finding their guilt after trial.
Before I ask the questions, the bills in question have a line, the court may not terminate the period of probation or intensive probation earlier than that originally imposed if the defendant was convicted of a dangerous crime against children as defined in section 13705. There's also a line in here related to earned time credits. I just want to go with that. If you're on probation for a dangerous crime against children, you may not be eligible for earned time credit. However, that's already in the statute because number 4 of subsection D, if you're required to register pursuant to 1338-21, which all of these DAC cases are, you're already excluded from ECC, but it's within the bill. So are there questions for Ms. Ballner related to 13-705 at this time? At this time, I'm going to open up with a statement related to early termination of probation. When I served
nearly 25 years with the Maricopa County Adult Probation Department. Most of my time was in the second division, as many of you know. I was tasked with meeting the development of criteria to guide whether the department could support an individual on probation for a sex offense and petitioning the court for early termination. That work was not done lightly and was not done alone. The committee included a judicial officer who presided over sex offender hearings, psychologists, victim advocates, defense attorneys, prosecutors, probation leadership, and recognized experts. Similar to this board, every perspective had a seat at the table. The criteria we developed were rigorous. Individuals are required to undergo comprehensive assessments, including offense-specific evaluations, sex history polygraphs, which sometimes uncovered previously undisclosed offending behavior. When sex offender treatment is delivered correctly, it addresses deviant sexual arousal of present sexual misbehavior patterns, cognitive distortions, accountability, and risk factors. We also examine performance on supervision, compliance, behavioral stability, internalization of treatment concepts, polygraph results over time, and demonstrated offense-free living in the community, just to name a few. The criteria specifically considers empirically supported predictors of sex offense, sexual reoffense, including deviant sexual interest and psychopathy. These are serious evidence-based risk markers. At the same time, every case is different. In my career, across thousands of cases, no two individuals are identical. The criteria for early termination should not be secret from victims, individuals on supervision, their families, or the public. And transparency builds trust. Decisions that impact public safety deserve clarity and accountability. The process was challenging, and it should be. Committing a sex offense and later requesting relief from supervision is a serious matter. However, we must also acknowledge that supervision itself should be appropriately structured and evidence-driven. In some cases, supervision should be more intensive, and others, continued lifetime monitoring without review may not enhance public safety. Excluding individuals from early termination based solely on a single statutory enhancement implies that other serious elements of sexual offending are somehow less grave, and that is simply not accurate. Each case must be evaluated on its merits based on risk, behavior over time, and validated factors, not a single legal label. For far too long in Arizona, there has been limited transparency around how these cases are prosecuted and supervised. Victims, individuals, beginning probation, and families often do not understand the process. At times, systematic issues have been avoided rather than addressed. I'm also concerned about eliminating judicial discretion. Judges are charged with weighing facts, evidence, and risk in individual cases. We must also account for developmentally delayed individuals, the elderly, and those who may become mentally or medically incapacitated. There are cases where individuals are bedridden or must relocate for full-time care. Public safety resources are finite. We should direct intensive supervision toward individuals who continue to present measurable risk, rather than adopting blanket policies that do not distinguish between levels of danger. This board has been in place only a few months, and I am deeply proud of the commitment that I see, especially from our subcommittees, which are working diligently and thoughtfully. I stand by the seriousness and rigor of the criteria developed through the years of collaboration and multidisciplinary efforts. I do have full confidence that this board will make a deliberate evidence-based recommendation to the legislature regarding early termination, and one that carefully balances risk assessment, victim safety, judicial oversight, and responsible stewardship of supervision resources. Our judges need the best and most current information possible. The decisions they make affect public safety victims and potential future victims, individuals under supervision, and the integrity of our judicial system. And with that, I'm going to open it up to the board for comment on this bill. Yes.
I just want to add that on those two bills, there is a difference between them. One of them says unless under the age of 18. So there is a distinction between the two. I don't know if that's important to anybody, but one says gives no exceptions, the other one does for an offense that was committed prior to the time.
Thank you. Ms. Karachi, can it be? Probably this, I think, is from the, I do believe that's covered under our ARH statute too, that juveniles are covered in that statute, but thank you for that. Clarification also, etc. Ms. Karachi, did you have your?
Okay, I'm looking at these bills. I know there's one pending legislation. I don't remember if it's one of these that excludes from the 13-923. It also doesn't allow those children to petition to get off early. Don't think that's either. Oh, yes. HB 2966 would also prevent someone who was a minor at the time of their offense under 13-923 from terminating their probation earlier than originally imposed. So when we're talking about earlier than originally imposed, we're practically talking about people who have been on life probation. So if they were imposed for a lifetime, there would be no early termination for those juveniles. And just for clarification, are we discussing both of them together? Or did you want to do one or the other?
Psychiatrist and director of other cities or inner city treatment programs. Early termination is a huge incentive to get buy-in from the individual. And so we're disincentivizing them. That's why you make treatment and rehabilitation harder in the community, let's say, and give people less reason to not offend when they're in that frustrated, and I don't care anymore, I'm going to give up. That's a huge merit that I think that make that up harder to the other.
Madam Chair, this is Colette, and I would like to know again or have it read what a dangerous crime against children is defined as in 13705, because it includes trafficking. And so I would like to have that read again.
Victoria Baldwin, Madam Chair, the blurb I read is taken from the fact sheet. If you want me to read all 13705, it could probably take half an hour.
I'm sure I actually have it pulled up in front of me. If we read probably the very first part of it, I think that clarifies. If you don't mind. Okay, I don't mind at all. And so it says a dangerous crime against children means any of the following that is committed against a minor who is under 15 years of age or against a person posing as a minor if the defendant knew or had reason to know that the deported minor was under 15 years of age. And it goes into the list that Victoria referenced about what those actual charges are. So really, as Victoria said, the victim was under the age of 15, or the defendant believed that the victim was under the age of 15.
And Peter Murray again, I just want to clarify the subtext of my God, the considerations. My issue with this post legislation is it's just too broad, and then that it's too ironclad for the situation they have, but well, that's what Joseph Goldman is saying. There is a rigorous process, and it's merit-based, or it does get a service. So it's not that it happens in that field anymore. I think this legislation would take discretion away.
Yeah, it's, I think, vital information that's scripted to nowhere, and it's not actually probation.
Scott Nagle, not entirely sure who the group of people were that were involved in crafting the provision for people petitioned to get off lifetime probation, but they had their arms around this concept that Peter Moore is talking about, and that is motivation and hope, something to look forward to and something to embrace. And there's lots and lots and lots of research on what happens to people when they are absent hope and don't have hope. And although it'd be difficult to predict the untoward effects of some of this, there will be untoward effects. And it will be on the front of some of the dynamic risk factors being increased, not reduced. And I think it plays itself out well if the quest here is community safety.
So I think that the provisions or the introduction of these bills is more based off of, you know, a few heinous crimes that have taken place, and there's a lot of emotion behind it, and I feel like emotion is lacking logic, and so it's not always the best thing to do, but politics are a lot of emotion, so I get that. The other part of this is people are up for, or they go up for early termination hearings all the time, and they get denied on a very regular basis. It's not one of those, hey, I'm, you know, trying to get off of probation, and the judge says, oh, okay, what have you done? And they say, oh, I've done this, this, and this. And, okay, you're good to go. You're off suspension. That does not happen. That is a very rare thing. And the fact that guys are on lifetime probation, typically they have this understanding of after 7 years, they're eligible to petition to get off of lifetime probation. And that is something that attorneys are telling these guys when they take their plea deals. And I feel like, one, we're doing a disservice by calling it lifetime probation. If we're going to really say it's lifetime probation, but then attorneys are telling these guys before they sign their plea, that's not really lifetime. After 7 years, you can petition to get off. And then this says, nope, if you sign for lifetime, it's lifetime. If you're 23, it doesn't matter. 50 years later, if you're 83, you're still on probation. That's a waste of resources, state resources. And, you know, I think it, as a board, it's our duty to make sure that we're providing logic to the emotional legislation that's being provided. And introduced, and nothing really is gained, but plenty is lost in the introduction of both of these bills.
This is Katie Crutchy. So to kind of piggyback on that, what we heard from Dr. Blades at an earlier session was about risk needs responsivity, and that we should be supervising the highest risk people. The people that I see that are petitioning that the court is letting off are the lowest risk individuals. And this makes it offense-based instead of risk-based. There could be someone that doesn't have a DCAC that's a higher risk and that should remain on probation. And there could also be someone, oftentimes with the DCAC, we see younger individuals, maybe they're 17, 18, 19, with someone who is, you know, 14 who represented themselves to be 18, that person shouldn't necessarily be on lifetime probation based on, you know, when they go through treatment for the rest of their life until they're 80, 90 years old. So this is not risk-based, which is what we're tasked with. It doesn't make the community safer.
Thank you. So I agree for the most part. I think the intent, of course, is to keep the most dangerous people on probation as long as possible. The problem is that DCAC is just a legal term. It's just a sentencing enhancement. So it doesn't actually capture who the most dangerous people are. That's done in other ways, and it doesn't speak to the facts of the case at all. So it speaks to maybe how good your attorney is, or, you know, what kind of, how good a plea you got, but it doesn't speak to the facts of the case. So it also kind of implies that those that don't have a DCAC case are better. They might be a better candidate to be on probation. And in practice, I mean, realistically, in probation, standard practice, if it's a non-sex offense case, is people, for the most part, get off at halftime. So if you have 3 years for the drug charge, you normally get off a year and a half. ETC, you cut that down to a year. But what will happen, really, is if this was in effect, you just see pleas for 99 years. It wouldn't change anything. And then they'd be eligible for halftime early termination at 45 years. So it's going to have unintended consequences as well, because there's going to be just workarounds to that. So it's just a legal term. And honestly, I don't think it's worded very well in general. I mean, talking about, you know, that the intensive probation can be terminated early. That's not how IPS works. IPS is normally just for a year or so at the beginning of probation, and then they're modified to standard as they progress on. So you can't leave somebody on intensive probation for, you know, 100 years. And even the ETC conversation, I get the point, but it is definitely captured above. Any DCAC is going to be either lifetime at class 2 or 3 and or required to register. So it's repetitive, and I don't think it's worded very well.
Thank you all. Any last minute comments? I think it worked fine. Yeah. Ask for a vote. Motion to.
I'm sure we'll be before we can go to the full body and score it.
Wait, Barney, I have a motion for code.
Which one? SB 1829 first.
Yes, motion for a vote on SB 1829.
Okay, we'll do HB 2966 first. Do I have a second?
Mr. Barney, would you ask for that? Yes, no, friendly amendment. Could we have your motion be to either oppose or support? You have to say one way or another what your motion is. Thank you.
I motion for either in opposition for the bill HB 2966. Or a vote to her.
Yes, it's 2996. 2966. 2966.
Well, I just want to make sure the record is clear on that which one what bill we're voting.
First one would be HB 2966.
Okay, thank you.
And that, Mr. Brian, you're calling for a vote to have the board oppose the legislation. Okay. Do I have a second?
Katie Gucci, I have a second button.
I ask for a roll call vote.
Can I ask a clarification?
Yes.
Shane, are we voting it as written?
Yes. Opposed as written in current form. Can I have a roll call vote?
Chairman Boland?
Yes.
Ms. Atkins?
Yes.
Mr. Barney?
Yes.
Dr. Blades?
Yes.
Ms. Chapman?
Abstain.
Detective Cook?
Yes.
Mr. Malarno?
Yes.
Dr. Gray?
Yes.
Mr. Hanratty?
Abstain.
Mr. Felroy?
Yes.
Ms. Krejci?
Yes.
Dr. Loki?
Yes.
Supervisor Clark?
Yes.
Dr. Miller?
Yes.
Dr. Maury?
Yes.
Ms. Music?
Yes.
Mr. Nagley?
Yes.
Mr. Neal?
Yes.
Ms. Oppheim?
Yes.
Mr. Pulaski?
Stay.
Judge M?
Yes.
The motion passes with 18 yes and 0 no's and 3 abstain.
Thank you. Do I have a motion for SB 1829?
This is Katie Crunchy. I would make a motion that we oppose SB 1829.
Do I have a second?
Yes, sir.
Not a huge clarification. We should make SB, but I'm reading HB as well. I just want to make sure we're actually something that's active.
Yes, the first one is SB and the other two are House bills. Thank you. Give up second, friends. Can I get a roll call vote, please?
I did not catch who the second was. I think it was Katie.
No, that was fine.
Thank you.
Chairwoman Golden?
Yes.
Ms. Atkin?
Yes.
Mr. Barney?
Yes.
Dr. Blades?
Yes.
Ms. Chapman?
Abstain.
Detective Cook?
No.
Mr. Galardo?
Yes.
Dr. Gray?
Yes.
Mr. Henry?
Abstain.
Mr. Conroy?
Abstain.
Scratchy?
Yes.
Dr. Lucky?
Yes.
Supervisor McClure?
Yes.
Dr. Miller?
Yes.
Dr. Maury?
Yes.
Ms. Music?
Yes.
Mr. Nagley?
Yes.
Mr. Neal?
Yes.
Ms. Open?
Yes.
Mr. Paulowski?
Abstain.
Judge Young?
Yes.
Madam Chair, the motion passes with 16 yes, 1 no, and 4 abstain.
Thank you. Point of clarification, will staff be preparing letters or how will this, that in its current written form, these bills are not or were not supported by the board, how will that convey it to the discussion point forward? Madam Chair, may I be heard to please?
Considering the way that the first communication with the legislature was conducted, as long as everybody's fine with it being put in letter form, I think there should be a letter for each bill. And then you sign it. Does that, I mean, you can put it to discussion, but if you feel like what we did the first time works.
I'm fine with what we did the first time. Does anybody else have any?
Okay.
I think that's fine to do the letter, but then if the school's interested in calls about them, she can also inform the representative maybe calling her that. Okay. Right? It's all this public record, so.
It is public record, so.
I guess anyone from the board, including the school, could inform someone who asked that just to help the outcome of the board meeting list.
For instance, if you get a call tonight, hope you don't. You can let the caller know we are preparing a letter in no support of this kind of legislation. That's fine.
Thank you.
Sure.
Moving on to G.
Actually, Madam Chair, I have a motion.
Yes, I move that we authorize the chairman to sign a letter to the legislature, meaning that this board has opposed the proposed all three of those fund benefits.
Do I have a second? And may I also add, will the governor's office yet?
You're asking?
I'll amend my motion to also add that we will have the governor's office on the vote. Thank you. Do I have a second?
Second, ma'am.
All those in favor?
I have to just wait to come. This lawyer got that picking. Ms. Welker mentioned that we don't support it. I would actually go as far as to say if his board will get to it. So that's not just a no. Actually, stating our opposition to this legislation.
I think I'd like to clarify our position was opposed in correct form.
Yes.
Correct.
So, and I wasn't expecting the motions to come across the way they did. We had planned to do vote to support, do not support, abstain. But the way that the motions were proposed, they all were fashioned in the same way, which was we were voting on whether to oppose, period. We'll make sure the letter says what the motion was. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstaining? Thank you, Mr. Nair, any abstaining?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you need a break?
Yes.
Okay, so let's take a 7 minute break. 7 minute, thank you. That's 30 seconds. Lucky. I don't know if your time is on your phone.
Language grade.
Thank you to Sergeants or Detective with the Mount County Sheriff's Office. Who's going to give us a presentation on the unification assessments? And I'll turn it over to thank you.
First, I'm okay with Sergeant. I'm going to talk to the sheriff when we're done here. I'm going to reference sometimes to my colleagues, which is Sergeant Patina and Investigator Patina. We're over here. They both work in my office as well. Introduction, my name is Van Cooper, Detective with the Sheriff's Office. I have 32 years of law enforcement, 30 years with Pinal County. Our sole job between me and Investigator Patina is sex offender registration. So they cut my presentation, you guys would be happy to know they cut my presentation in half. So with the limited time to get us learning for all nighter.
That's okay, I'll be back next month too. Yeah,
I was welcome. Yeah. This is my okay. So let's go, we'll go right into it, we'll go straight to the next one. Who, and that's, go ahead, there we go. Talking about who gets notified. Remember we talked about statutes and how they're written. The first statute tells us this is within 133825, which is the community notification status that guides us on how to do notifications and who to notify. Our first one says that we have to notify the surrounding neighborhood. That's as specific as it gets. So when I first came in, it was governed by money. We could only spend up to $100 to notify the community as far or narrow as that got. We've now changed that to where we notify pretty much countywide to 1,000 feet. It's not governed in statute. We pick up the rules on that. So I know there are some agencies that just do the minimum of $35 for the notification, and whatever that goes to, that's what gets notified. So this is where we don't have any clarification or working. Where a statute was written where we didn't have any input to know what it meant. Area schools as well. So if you're working from a county level, what is an area school? What schools are in that community, whether it's whatever kind of school, charter schools, little schools that aren't non-existent almost versus school districts and that. We've struggled with that. We're still working on trying to get our a wraparound of all the schools that are in our areas. We have come to on a county level, we put out a notification. If there's a notification required, we notify all schools in our county because we don't know where school bus stops are. I know some of the charter schools cross over and go long distances to kids up. So we notify all schools of those that are a notification level. And then appropriate community groups. Really, we have no idea what appropriate community groups mean. We notify prospective employers. We have no idea what that means. You know, we could notify all the employers within the county if they're prospective, but you never know where a person's going to work. And then the last one is the latest newsy that we had. If the offender has legal custody of the child's school, legal custody is defined as the right to possess a child. We have no idea what to do with that definition. It is not any definition that you would think for legal custody. It's if you can possess a child. So as a neighbor, if I run the van pool as a sex offender, does he have to disclose that? He has possession of those children legally. He should be disclosing that. Grandparents, aunts, uncles, neighbors, friends, boyfriend, girlfriend, if they have the right to possess a child, they should be disclosing that. It's a class 4 felony to not disclose those children. We have no idea where to go. We've been working on this. This was in that last revision of the notification level, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. That's one of those where we should have had time to discuss it, and it went all the way through. It's become law, and now there's, well, you know, what can we do about it? I'm not sure what the intent of it is. I think I know that they want these schools to know when there are children there that have parents as sex offenders, but that's not the way it's written. So this is what I was talking about earlier on the levels that are assigned, which we're going to go over this assessment level. Levels 1 through 3 are known, 3 being the most at risk, the highest risk, 1 being the lowest risk. But there's a fourth category that most people don't know about. We call it DPS, and through the state as an L&M, which is the statute 133825 L&M. That L is what I was talking about earlier. The section does not apply to persons who are subject to the registration requirements as a result of offenses adjudicated by a juvenile court, unless it's ordered by the court. So unless the court specifically orders that that juvenile, otherwise they're going to be in this subcategory of a level, which would be an L&M, and that is for the duration of their registration, which should be for 10 years, because at age 25, they would be removed from the registration as the current statute tells us. M talks about the older offenses prior to 1996 were the current model that we're using. Prior to that, they would be, or can be, it's a may, can be ruled as an L&M. Our county right now is doing the L&M. There are some that are not doing the L&M, that they are doing an assessment on every offender. Well, the biggest problem is getting paperwork and being just to a person whose conviction was prior to 1996. We have, in our state, we have 4 that were convicted prior to 1965. We have 4 people on the registry with a conviction that old. We're not going to get those papers. We're not going to get the conviction paperwork or police reports, which are required for our assessment. That's the biggest reason why we have this May, is because of the age of it. It's more difficult paperwork. And I that last paragraph, that's what should have been there. But go ahead. No, sorry, go back to the other one. Level 1, this is who gets the notification. Level 1 with the DCAC. We went over the DCAC charge of dangerous crime against children. So if you're level 1, you have a DCAC conviction, or you're a level 2 or level 3, there's going to be a notification. Our problem lies in the fact that whether or not your conviction was out of state. In Pinal County, we have about 1,000 sex offenders. 400 of them come from out of state convictions, which means I have to go to those states, gather the conviction at the year of conviction, translate that to an Arizona conviction, find out if there was a minor that was involved in that, which would make it a DCAC charge, and then determine whether or not they're going to be DCAC. In Arizona, the judge decides whether or not they're DCAC. It's very simple. I just look at the conviction. It's 13705 is there, or dangerous crime against children is determined. The way it's written right now, those 400, I have to decide, or my office has to decide whether or not they're they fall within the DCAC statutes. Fair, not fair, I don't know, but that's what we're stuck with the way that the law was written. You have to do that that interpretation. And then for level 1s with the non-DCAC and the L&M status, there's not a notification. I'll give one exception, and a change to this is the online notification process that's done. That's done by DPS. DPS is responsible. That's 3827. Their criteria for DCAC is under the age of 12. So if the victim was under the age of 12, they appear on the website if they don't fit into those categories. So that bottom one where it's level 1, if the victim was under 12, that person could still end up on the website. The only exception to that whole rule. And we went over this, so I don't need to spend much time on it. My DCAC is under the age of 15. If they are 14 years of age or under, they fit my criteria for the level 1 DCAC, they would get the notification by that statute. I'm trying to, I know you guys are on time, so I don't think, unless you guys have questions, if you have something, let me know. Otherwise, I'm just going to zip to where we get to that assessment part. Community notifications have to include the following information. This is done through our Offender Watch program for the most part. We can go through the program that DPS runs, which is Offender Watch. It regulates and maintains the records of all our sex offenders. We can ask them to mail flyers to an address, and we put in what the radius is. We put in 1,000 feet radius, and they mail them to that community for us. There are exceptions. Arizona City, within our county, we cannot do that. It's a post office driven community. We have to go out, we go out and hand deliver those door to door. They have to be paper. They cannot be electronic. So we go, hopefully not in summer. If it isn't summer, we're out there at like 3 in the morning. Not that early. After 6:30 in the morning, we're out going door to door, putting flyers on doors to maintain. We have 3 different areas in our county that we have to do that. So door to door for that part. This is the information that's required on those flyers. Those flyers go out and then it's given to print media as well. You can advance. That's what the flyer would look like. That's the one that's generated by Offender Watch. We have our own that we make. That's a little bit differently, but this is like a postcard size. It just gives the general information of the offender. There would be a photograph in that top right corner that gives a picture of what the offender looks like. It's a black and white picture. And then a phone number for our office is included on there. We have to go in and put the level on there. There's not an area designated for the level. So we make sure to put it in 2 places, one up in the comment and second down on the offense. Those aren't designated areas. That's where my county does it. So all of them may not do it that same way. I'm not sure what the other ones do. This is where we're going to start getting into the community note, the risk assessment. We have, once a person moves into my county or comes to register with me for the first time, I have 45 days to complete an assessment. So the assessment that we're about to go over, I have to complete. Before we can do that, we have to obtain the court documents, the police reports, prison records. Any information that you're going to see on this assessment as we go through it, we try to do our best to have it in writing. We want some documentation. We don't want to make anything up. We don't take the word of the person that's on the registry. We want things in writing as best as we can. If we cannot get all the information, we're required to put them as a level 2. So if I can't find a police report, some agencies don't maintain them that long around the state. If I can't find the police report, I can't do a legitimate assessment. I have to put it as a level 2. They get the community notification and so on from that level. So it's important to be able to get those, and now all states are on the same page as we are. We're about to go into the assessment, and if you guys want, I printed it up 20 copies. So I have copies if you guys would like them. I was just gonna send them, you guys can pass them down.
Well, in terms of folks passing those out, I just want to remind the board that it is in statute that we're looking at this assessment at some point, so I appreciate you.
So what you have to understand is we're cops. We're not doctors. We're not counselors. And sorry, we have no experience in why this assessment is what it is. We can read the assessment and do what the assessment tells us. Our county, the way that we do it, and we've encouraged the city agencies within our county, will assist them in doing this, is we form a committee. So my sergeant will be there, my entire office will be there, and any other agencies that are involved will be inside there. And we will discuss the assessment as a group to make a determination as to each question as we go through it. So you'll see on there each question gets, I'm sure you guys have seen this stuff before. You know what we're talking about. I do want to note that if you look at the top of that assessment, the year for this is 2002. That's when this assessment was developed and implemented. We've been using it since.
Yes. It's not naming questions. When you use the 2002 date, is that when the replication study of the instrument was done? When the first version of the study was done?
I'm going to refer that to Chairman Golden.
So what I know is that this is a DOC assessment, and maybe Mr. Neal remembers, because when we trained on this assessment, we met with DOC multiple times. So I do know they say it's a validated assessment. I don't know details other than that.
I can tell you that the statute does not regulate what assessment we use. The statute says that the state's assessment is what we have. It tells us that we have to use the assessment determined by the state. So I believe it's within this board's view to change this if deemed.
It's not any reason. Is there any way we can
seek to track down? I know there was a replication, like there was a study done on the instrument to revalidate the instrument at some point in time, but I'm not clear about whether or not that was 2002 date or 18 later than that.
Thank you, Mr. Engel. That's a good point. I wonder, Major Mitchell, is it possible to have staff contact Director Tornell's office and their communication team, which Mr. Miller used to work with frequently, so I know that maybe they'd be able to help us with that question. Oh, please.
That list again, I want to make sure.
The list of, so anyone, thank you, the communication team at DOC, whoever's in charge of that, should be able to get us that information. That would be great. Awesome. That would be
great. Just maybe an office together.
Yeah, thank you. Specifically, Mr. May, will you repeat what you were asking for, the second validation study, is that correct?
So, I think there's been one validation study of the original instrument. There may have been another one since then that I'm not aware of, but it's been 15 or 20 years since I heard about that. Could well be your 2002 date, it's accurate. I don't know.
Yeah.
And I have a copy of it somewhere in it.
Thank you.
I know that there's a study on there. I saw the original at one time from back in 2001 when it was discussed, and then 2002 it was implemented. I think one of the key things that I want to stress with you guys when we're discussing this is prior to the current problem we're having with social media and online problems. This is 2002, prior to the explosion that we're in now. And we see it on our end. We see that this assessment does not address that whatsoever. Or at some times you can put it into places, but it really lacks the inclusion of social media and some of the problems that we're having with online crimes and things like internet crimes against children and such. So let's jump right into this. You guys have more expertise than I do, but this is the first question. There are 19 that we have to go over as we go through this assessment. The first one talks about the number of convictions. I can let you guys read that, but for the public score, the total number of formal legal convictions for sex and sex-related offenses, including the current offense, score worth felony and misdemeanor convictions, as well as any juvenile convictions, adjudications. If several counts occurred in one trial, count those as one conviction. Separate trials indicate separate convictions. This to us has been a problem. I have an offender who came from California. He spent 2 months going from hotel to hotel looking for open doors and committing sexual assaults when he found open doors. 2 months worth. It was taken into one trial. It was one conviction. So I can't show the fact that for 2 months he was making it an everyday thing for him to go out and commit that sexual assault. I had to put it into one offense. And that's just one example that I can bring off the top of my head. There's multiple problems with that. Now, you guys, again, this is you know, top guy talking to doctors and such. So that's the problem that we face when we come into our committee is how is this doing justice to that type of situation. So again, if it's one, the points are zero. If it's two, they get the S score and the G score, which if you guys aren't familiar, there's a sex offense score, which is the crime itself, and then the G score is the general recidivism, the likelihood of reoffending. Those two scores throughout this process, and I hope most of you guys know that, but some may not. Through that process, you're going to have two scores at the end, one for the S score, one for the G score. Okay, number of convictions for felony offenses. This is not sex-related offenses. This is any felony offenses within their past criminal history. Again, you're going to get the S score and the G score for this. So another thing that we're going to do is go through and bring up a criminal history and look at a complete background of a person. Number three is going to talk about offenses for which they weren't convicted. This is not including if it was all grouped into one conviction, we can't score it here as a not convicted. It's got to be something, a separate offense outside of that trial. So this number three for, or which is sex offenses that were not convicted. I also want to add, per ARS for R1321, a failure to register is a sex offense. So if you have a failure to register, question number one is going to have at least two. Your original offense and then a failure to register counts as a sex offense. So now you would have two convictions for sex offenses. So if we go back, maybe next month or whenever we're doing it, I'm going to show you in 3821 the offenses that get you on there. Failure to register is one of them. Whether it's a misdemeanor in another state or a conviction in Arizona, it's going to be a sex offense. The age of first conviction, for some of you guys, that makes sense. For us, we score based on it. We don't understand it, but we score based on what it says. So if it's 23 years of age or younger, they're going to get points. I know you guys are like chomping to talk, so go ahead. No, another time.
Unless anybody had a clarifying question about the way, I think some of our psychologists can answer the why if they want to, or if there's a why you get more points. Anybody?
I just want to add that at some point, if we decide to change or to keep this, it's important that the people who are doing the assessment understand why we're scoring the way we are. Because we sit in a room and discuss this, and we're disgusted by some of the questions as to why we're doing it, and it motivates us to opinion-based change that assessment based on this is ridiculous, we don't understand it. We need to understand why we're doing it, and we don't. Other than, you know, here and there, we get opinions. So.
Mr. Nagler, go ahead.
I was just going to make two comments. I found the name of the original researcher, named Daryl Fisher. That name, and perhaps with Daryl Fisher's name attached to it, PhD Daryl Fisher, tracked research study that was done. The age issue is morphed across time. It really boils down to the younger you are, the more impulsive you are, the more risky you are. But the age in the static instruments was once defined a certain way, has been redefined in recent years to suggest that the older a person is, the less
that. And I'll add another thing just for awareness is we do this one time. When they come to our county, we're going to do this one time. And they could be in our county for 20, 30 years. It won't be done again. It's they're going to get the assessment, and then there's nothing in statute that tells us to do it. If you're in Maricopa County, you have 10,000 people on the registry. You don't have the ability to just, when they desire it, for you to do another assessment. It's not feasible. In Al County, we have 1,000. That would mean I'd have to do almost just less than 3 a day in order to keep up if they wanted them changed. So this is done one time when they first come in, and then that level sticks with them throughout eternity.
Dr. Miller, so it's not redone. It's not redone if they commit a new offense.
If we know of the reoffense, yes. That can sometimes be difficult because we may not get told. We may not know if they've reoffended. It's a difficult thing because, again, I would have to start doing criminal histories on 1,000 sex offenders per year to know and to keep up with. I mean, if I've done the conviction and I put it through the process in my office, we're going to know. But oftentimes, I may not know if the city's done it or if another county within the state has convicted. I may not know.
And Dr. Miller, again, just to your point, you know, you guys are feeding this assessment, not quite understanding where some of these questions are coming from. Just a quick glance, a lot of these look like they're tied to the static 99R or 799, which is an actuarial risk assessment. I don't know if you're always aware of that connection or if that might help.
From what I understand is those assessments are done like every 6 months or more often. And that was, again, the cop talking, they're more done more often. We do it one time. So this is going to be a long-standing score that I'm giving this guy. Is this the right thing for us to do is the question that we have. Often we're doing this because it's going to live with that guy forever.
So this is Carlo, the one thing that I'm stating the obvious for all the experts, I'm not an expert in this at all, that this actually is static because I don't understand that. I mean, I understand age of first conviction was younger than 23, they're more impulsive, but what if you're doing this when they're in Ontario County and they're 40? So you're missing the whole timeline here, first conviction. That's something that doesn't make quite a lot of sense to me. I would say legend.
Yes, the entity assessment, which I know that people get to when someone completes treatment.
Yeah.
I know that people on probation needs to have a call with the notification items to see if they would change their score when they completed treatment successfully. Because if people were on the verge of a level, that was a big deal. If we were like a letter or two, and so some detectives would change that score, and the dog is just, it was just to touch that.
And that would be the other missing piece, if that's not even. How is that really a risk assessment?
Scott, any commentary? You raise a really good issue. This instrument has had no work done on it in at least 20 years. And in that 20-year period, that there hasn't been any work done on this instrument is when all the work on SOTIPs and the stable and all of these dynamic risk scales come into existence. And so this doesn't speak to any of that stuff, which is of concern for sure.
Okay. I can tell you it is very rare for someone on the registry to call me and tell me that they completed counseling. It's very rare. Most of the time, you're going to, and if you'll see this at the end, you're going to get 3 points taken away from your assessment. If you've completed sex offender treatment, you're going to lose a total of 3 points. Most of the time, that's not going to do anything. But they still don't, we don't get any notification. It's rare. We are trying to let these guys know more about what's going on. We try to keep them informed. We've been getting a few more lately, but it's hit and miss. We rarely get any. Okay.
This is Barton Blaze. How do you know how it's determined the point values assigned to one? Like, for example, you said you get minus 3 points in complete treatment. So why? How do we arrive at 3?
It's the scores are right there. That's all I know. The scores are given to me on that sheet.
Scott made the comment about that. They're weighted from the original research that the instruments created. And then since we validated, so statistical analysis was done on which items get more weight than other ones.
So if we get the research potentially out, would be in there.
It would be in there, I think. Yes. Thank you.
But yeah, that answer. Okay. Use of a weapon in the sex-related offense. So if there was a weapon used, and then again, they give us a definition in there, so it says that a weapon is defined as an object or implement with a potential for inflicting lethal injury. The term includes a firearm implied as well. So we look at this. This is where the police report's important. We need to know the details. Sometimes we're able to complete it with the probation report that they give to the courts if there was one at that time. Sometimes. In order to answer this question, we have to have that police report or we have to have that pre-sentence report. If we don't have them, we can't answer the question. And we generally throw this towards that level too, that if we can't answer the question, we've got to do what the statute tells us. And so this guy, if we don't have that, they would go towards that level two automatically. Total number of victims in all sex offenses. This is where we start to look at things like child pornography and the downloading of photographs. because you can have thousands of victims. So those guys are going to get scored maximum points because we have thousands of victims in the downloading of child pornography. Those guys often get this higher level because of what we do is look at the report, how many pictures were mentioned in the report, and that's where this score comes from. If they only downloaded one photograph, which is almost never, then they're going to start to get the scores here, which will lead us into another one later on. This one, if they're downloading child pornography, normally it tells us if it was both sexes, and they're going to get those points as well. This is another one that chapped. I had to calm my sheriff down when we went over this because of this question. He said, why don't females count when we're doing an assessment? And I had to tell him, I don't know.
That's an erroneous assumption. Why don't females count?
Well, their score is zero.
So I did find the research on this. As I believe I promised a major or so ago. So the research shows that offenders who have offended against male children or male adults recidivate at a higher rate compared to those who do not have male victims. Having male victims is correlated with measures of sexual deviance and is seen as an indication of increased sexual deviance. And then the research here is posted. So just that is where that comes from.
And then we had the question of how current is this question still, and you guys would have to answer, you know, I don't know the data that you're bringing up, but our question would still be, you know, is this the current philosophy? Is this still the way that things are done 25 years after this assessment? And I see some head shaking, so maybe it is still a relevant question. But again, the ability to, for us to be able to explain this, you know, I meet with my city agencies within my county on a regular basis, and I can answer questions for them, but I have to have the answers for me.
Ms. Bezek, did you have a word?
Yeah, just out of curiosity, is that research for both male and offenders, or just for males?
So it does not let us exchange it if the offender is female. We still have to score it the same way. You can see that within the question.
And I have a similar question, so maybe one of the psychologists could answer this. So we talked about this seems to be based on like the static 99R. Is the static 99R an assessment that's used on people who commit child porn possession? Sorry, my name is Katie Fetching.
Static 99, static 2002R cannot be used for child pornography offenders. Now, if they have a hands-on offense in their history and they get arrested for child pornography, that instrument can, if they only have a child sexual exploitation in their history.
Okay. So let's go. Relationship of offender to victim. We have the family, acquaintance, and stranger. We use this same criteria. We use the criteria of known versus not known when we're doing the community notification. We don't put the words family on the community notification, but we also want the public to know if that stranger category is in there when we're doing the notification. So as we write that public notification statute, we don't say a family, we will say acquaintance or stranger, known or unknown to the offender. But those are important ones as well. I'm sure you guys understand the relevance of the family versus stranger versus acquaintance. We've also developed our and if you can go back one, I think it does kind of define the difference between family and acquaintance. We have, as a group, decided that family is any family member that lives in the home. If it is a family member that does not live in the home, we classify them as an acquaintance, just because they're not within that family structure. Not sure if that was the gist of the question, but that's how we've come to score this category as our count. Thoughts on me? No thoughts, it's good thoughts for me.
Jim Vanneretti, just go back to that one slide. There you go. Sexual in general, under acquaintance B, 0 to 6. So if it's an acquaintance,
on a non-sex crime, they get a score. They get a big number.
Correct.
They don't get anything. That's on sex.
Correct. You're talking if it's family?
Yeah. Well,
is that a question?
Like, it's their acquaintance.
I'm not sure what your question.
Well, the question is a zero score on the sex events for.
Right. That's exactly what it says there. So with zero, there's.
Right. On the F score, yes. The sex offense score.
Commentary. These are all statistically determined. Okay. Sometimes statistics don't make sense to. So we're looking for it.
That's 6 months.
Yeah.
That's what's playing itself out here. It's there.
And this is Katie Frenchy, another point of clarification. So when we talk about the sex offense score, at the end, you get a score for sex offense and you get a score for general recidivism. So if they're like high risk for general recidivism, they're still scored in like a level 2 or 3 sex offender. It's not necessarily that they have an acquaintance victim for a non-sex offense that you've committed in their past. It's all based on their sex offense history. They get a sex score and a general score. You score all the sex scores, you score all the general scores, you get a total combined sex offense recidivism risk, and then total general recidivism risk, and then both. Like, there's certain categories that assessment will say at the end of what makes someone a lot deeper. And then the date rape question, so if they knew them under 24 hours, they might be considered a stranger, which makes them higher risk.
Or,
at least for them.
I can read this is longer, but a victim is considered a stranger if the victim did not know the offender 24 hours before the offense. Victims contacted over the internet are not normally considered strangers unless the meeting was planned for the time less than 24 hours after the initial communication.
I know we want to keep them down longer, yeah. But the definitions of these categories are probably outlined in the manual. For this instrument, the definitions for these categories and other instruments may not match up with the definitions of categories in this instrument. That's really important. Understand.
Okay. Okay. So use of force is one that I'm going to spend a little time on. Use of force within the offense that occurred in this offense. Use of force. That's the next one. So use of force is talking about that's okay. We'll talk about this first. Use of force. So the greatest degree of force used during the offense. So we're looking at whether physical force, like the person was physically restrained by some kind of violence or bodily harm, whether there was a beating that occurred during the offense, that kind of thing is what we're looking at. And it can kind of go, if you hit the next one, it can kind of blend in my thoughts with this one, which is other characteristics of it. So we see the last category, victim tortured or mutilated. We see victim tied up, handcuffed or bound. These two can kind of be put together. One of the things that we were looking at and have come across in many cases is I had one where the victim showed up to the suspect's business, the offender's business, and while she was there, she complained of being ill. He gave her something to drink, knocked her out. He then raped her while she was unconscious. Does that fit into being bound or tied up? He made her unconscious at that time. The same thing can be found when you're dealing with alcohol. When you have people at a party, alcohol is involved, you know that person is getting intoxicated and it becomes intoxicated to the point where they're no longer conscious. Does that fit within the victim tied up, handcuffed, or bound? And our agency has been scoring those circumstances as tied up, handcuffed, or bound. We've been giving those because we feel that is an overact on the side of the offender to bind that person and to keep them from moving and going away. Go ahead.
So what I'm hearing is you guys are doing your very best to score as true as possible, but you just have to make quite a few judgment calls.
Correct. Correct. We are making calls. And the thing is when we make these calls, we have the understanding that this score that we're giving this person could be for life. So we're weighing that as we decide that we're going to give them the points on this. We know that potentially that score is going to stay with that offender as long as they're living in my county and in my jurisdiction. That score will probably never change. Once they move to another jurisdiction, there is potential for that other jurisdiction to reassess. They don't always do it. I would say a lot of times they're not doing a reassessment on the offender. They're maintaining the one that currently exists.
So this seems like, sorry. So then what I'm hearing, if you guys are making more judgment calls, when you will be honest, then they would go somewhere else. And they're also going to make their judgment calls.
Right. That could trigger a reassessment. Not necessarily. But it can trigger a reassessment for a person if they were to just move to a different jurisdiction.
So I can tell you, Missy, from our experience in probation, that oftentimes someone can move from Phoenix to another city to another, and they will be a different level. If that's your question or point.
That was the point. So yes, thank you.
We did have agencies and jurisdictions that had policy that were restrictive when it came to level threes. And so it was motivated to not make that person a level three. And so we would see it. Our probation was motivated to not have them as a level three. And so I know of an occasion where I assessed one, he became a level three. The next day he was a level two. And we had no idea why we stopped that. It doesn't happen anymore. But it was motivated because then they have to have the ankle monitor by probation, and there were other rules. So we go through this. We're responsible for this. We stopped probation from doing those assessments. There was a motivation to change it, and we can't afford that. Anyways, so those are the other characteristics. You can only have one of those offenses, so you cannot have multiple within this one question. The max score is a 3 and a 7. Length of sexual offense history. This is pretty easy if their offense history. Again, though, remember that failure to register is a sex offense. And so if they've done it beyond the 5 years, they're going to get the 5 points for committing a sex offense, which is not carrying a driver's license on potentially. So if you didn't carry your driver's license, you are convicted of failure to register, you're going to get points in both that top category, the number one, and in this number 11, you're going to get points just because you didn't carry your ID. Alcohol or drug usage, we refer back to the police report specifically to see if there was drug or alcohol mentioned in the report. We also refer to the criminal history to see what violations were occurring at the same time as the offense, to see if this was looked to be some kind of interference at the time of the offense. And then that score would be assessed as well. This is one, I don't know. I think we had it one time where we were able to determine whether this applied. But this is talking about a mental or cognitive impairment of the offender. We don't get this information. This is not, and we're not allowed to use what the registry, that person, what he tells us, we're not allowed to use. It specifically tells us do not credit self-reports without a diagnosis. We don't get doctor's information. We don't get this from anyone. So this question is pretty much ignored as we go through it. It never occurs. Like I said, we did have one, and I believe we got that report from probation. Because we got a probation report, and whether it was supposed to be or not, it was there, so we used it. Okay.
Question, Jim Manuel.
Yes.
Just off the top of your head, no hand in the fire, but how many juvenile registered sex offenders do that? Just ballpark.
I'm gonna refer to Andrew to see, because I know we ran through these. Okay, let me say this. There are 5 offenders in Arizona that were convicted in 2008. 2 of those offenders are under 18, and they will turn 18 this year, one in November, one in March. Otherwise, everyone is over 18. That is, and I checked the registry for this. Now, if you're asking how many were convicted as a juvenile, that's different. And I don't know those numbers off the top of my head, but I can tell you we have 5 in Arizona convicted in 2008. And of those, only 2 of them are right now under 18. They're 17 years old, going to be 18 this year. So I did run that number.
This is same as
the other end.
So I just wanted to say that the fact that you, that number 13, that you don't get that information is such a disservice to the developmental disabled and those who have IDP population. You don't even know, you can't get that information. That's putting them so much more vulnerable.
We go out of our way to give this to, we don't hide this assessment from anybody. If they want the assessment, we give it to them. They're able to see each of the questions and they're able to determine. I didn't ask for medical records and things like that. So we give them this assessment. That's the best I can do.
And then the point was made that if they did that, it would increase the risk. But that, again, that seems opposite to me because we want to know that that person does have some kind of barrier to understanding or anything like that. So that's really.
Okay, we'll move on. Employment history. So this is another one that is really there's gray area here. So if they don't have a job, we give them a score. We also have to determine whether or not they have stable employment when we're doing this assessment. So as a group, we had to decide what is stable employment. And we've judged that stable employment is 6 months at the same job. So if we give them a score for having unstable employment, we tell them, you are getting a score here, this 4 and 8, because you don't have a job. When you get the job in 6 months, come back. And we make sure that we clarify that with them. We did have one occasion where there was a person who had 2 jobs, and both of them were like 3 months and 4 months, but they were maintaining the 2 jobs. We decided that added to more than 6 months. We gave them the stable employment for having 2 jobs that equal more than 6 months. So, I mean, we're trying to do our best here, but we as a group come up with our own definitions on some of these terms.
This is Katie Crunchy. If there's many jurisdictions that will define this as whether or not the person was employed at the time of the offense, and there's no ability to change it.
You may have had the top of that last line earlier. I need it for juvenile. The intent to make measure is to measure the good faith report of the offender that the offender has made his or her time productive and responsible. And never had anything.
Suffered from some hearing problems, so I have no idea what you said.
I apologize. I was just trying to make a comment there about that last line about a good faith effort of the offender has made his or her time productively and responsibly, and ask them specifically.
So remember, I have 2 in the entire state that are under the age of 18.
Right.
We don't do assessments. The statute tells us that a person who is a juvenile or convicted as a juvenile becomes that L&M, and they're not going to get an assessment. So it tells my county if they're getting a level, I would mention the statute that says that they should. And I can give you that statute. It's 3825L.
Should be already gone. Just kind of stating the obvious here, that seems to be one thing.
Perfect.
Yeah, this is Katie Crunchy. When we're talking about the juvenile offenders, we're talking about juveniles that went to juvenile court, correct? Does that also include juveniles who were charged as adults?
So that says that they were adjudicated in juvenile. So you're right. We saw that as a difference, that saying that they were convicted in juvenile court versus adult court. If you have a juvenile that has gone through adult court and gets conviction, that's a conviction, not the adjudication, which the statute tells us. And so that may be why the people that you guys referenced as having the levels are there, because they weren't adjudicated that way. And in our mind, that's important in the determination that they're an adult, that they've been convicted as an adult. Okay. I'm trying to keep up on mine. So this is now the 15 talks about the characteristics. If you guys want to look at the rules that we have in there and the way that it's been guiding us, if you can call it that, it says avoid an overly broad interpretation, which we don't know whether we're being overly broad or not. We do our best. Again, this is by our committee when we come together. I can't talk to all the agencies when they do this. Remember that the assessment is done by the agency of jurisdiction. So when you come to the county to register, you have to come to the sheriff of each county. 15 counties, you have to go to that sheriff to register. Once you're done registering, that registration is now turned over to the agency of jurisdiction. If you live in the city, that city will do your assessment. If you live in the county, I'll do your assessment in my county. Each county is responsible the same way. So we have two jobs there. We fulfill the city role in the unincorporated areas, and then the city does the rest post registration, this assessment, and then upkeep after that. So we can move on to the next one. It's going to start to talk about these behaviors that we have to mark. And I'll skip ahead a little bit that we have to have three of these before we get a score. So one or two isn't going to count. We have to have three to get them all. You guys can see those on the papers in front of you. We go through to see whether or not we're going to get three of them. Understanding this is very important when we're going through there. This is the one time where you're going to see child pornography mentioned within this assessment. Right here under the hemophilia, you'll see viewing of child pornography can be included. That's the one spot where you're going to see it in this whole assessment mentioned. Otherwise, it's not talked about. Any questions on those? We can only score a 3 and a 0. You can't get any more. It doesn't matter how many X's you get. If it goes beyond 3, you're still only going to get 3 points. If it's under 3, there's no points. Do you have something?
Yeah, I mean, that's for the section on pedophilia, it says sexual contact with the male and female 14 and under. And then we're using for pornography. Are we including victims in the pornography we're working on under, or any child pornography is in this
one? We include any child pornography. Okay. And I believe that they're doing, but when they're convicting on the child pornography, they're looking for the prepubescent. So this is really going to hit that category. Because if you go back one slide, you have the hemophilia here, you have the pedophilia at the top, which is also going to talk about it, but you can't, I don't think we can't do both. So you'll get one or the other depending on what that photograph reveals. Oh, my bad, I made those this morning. I wasn't sure if everybody was going to have it, but I thought it was good to have it in your hands. So you know what those top two are here. Okay, we can move forward. Let's answer any questions. Okay, felony committed upon previous release from prison, jail, or juvenile facility treatment center. Again, we're addressing juveniles, but I'll tell you that it's when they're incarcerated as a juvenile if we get some of this behavior, not that we're assessing juveniles. So I think this is actually self-explanatory. We can move to 17, discipline history while in the jail. This is talking about major reports. So we allow the prison system itself to determine whether or not it was a major report. If it reflects a major report, then we're going to classify it that way. We do our best when they're incarcerated out of Arizona to get those prison reports. It's not an easy thing to get, but we do our best to get it. We let this take them into the level 2 category. If we can't get this information, we don't. Again, this is not standardized across the state, but in our county, we won't let this be one of the criteria to take them to an automatic level 2. substance abuse treatment, this is only applicable if the previous question was scored, the previous one about alcohol involvement. If they received the score there, then we now look to see whether they had the alcohol or substance abuse treatment, and then this would apply there if they did or did not. Not involved in treatment, involved but did not complete. Our two of them here, the next one will go even further. So this one is going to say failed to attend, failed to complete, denied admittance, or program not available. They're going to get the score. So even if it wasn't available to them, they didn't have a choice, they're going to get the score. It's 3 points, they're going to get it automatically. And I've had guys say, come in and say, well, it wasn't available to me. This doesn't really give me a choice on what I do here. I don't know why that's there, but I score it by what the assessment tells me to score. That's the 19 questions. At this point, we would add up the two different scores, the S score and the G score. Go ahead and hit that next slide. And right here is the determination of whether or not what level that they'll go in. You'll see at the top, you have the total for the sex offense, the S score. And for the general recidivism score, you'll have the G score. And we put them into the bottom to see where they fit. 20 is the magic number for the most part. Anything above that, they're going to start hitting level two. Level two is the notification level, and that's where everything falls from there. So it doesn't matter if you're a 70 or a 20, you're going to get a community notification. At least on that G side, you have to be a 21 on the S side. But then they're put into one of the three levels, and we move on from there. Questions over that? Now, what I didn't have on there, and I should have, is the last page of this. The last page of this, and I don't know, is it on there? Yeah, there is another page on there. Yeah. Okay, it's in the handout, but it wasn't on this. It talks about mitigating and aggravating factors, things. This is another area where we try to stay away from. We're trying to keep our opinions out of this as much as we can. We're trying to use the assessment tool that's put there. There are times where we have to give an opinion, but we try to do that as a group. But otherwise, we try not to talk about these mitigating and aggravating circumstances because, again, we're just putting opinion into something that's been developed for us to use the tool. But you guys can take your time to read over those factors that can be applied in there. That's the end of the total smoke. I was cut in half. So I feel like I took a piece of cake out of the center. In talking to you guys about this statute, because there is so much more involved that hopefully we can go over. The things that I wanted to reiterate is when we're looking at this, I look at it from everything that's done, I'm looking at it from an enforcement perspective. How can I enforce this? What am I going to be expected to do? My sole job is registration and tracking of sex offenders. That's what I do. That's my only job. When we put together these laws and start to make them, I'm looking at how that happens. When we look at things from a perspective of they're on their registry, only a third of the people on the registry are on probation. So if you're going to make a rule that says they have to go to counseling, how do I enforce that? Is that something that's going to be enforced? I looked, we have 5,000 in prison for sex offenses. We have 6,000 on probation. We have 10,000 that have no rules, no probation, no prison, no tails on them. There's 10,000 on there that we have to address outside of these. These are the best numbers that I could find. 5,000 in prison for sex offenses, which there's three categories that I put together, sex offense, and then there were two other ones that I think rape, and I can't remember what the other one was, but I combined the three of them and made 5,000. There's 6,000 that are on the registry for sex offender that are on probation or parole. And then there are 10,000 that have no restriction, and that's within Arizona. Other than they're on the registry.
Thank you.
That's all I have.
This is Dr. Miller. Has there been any consultation with other counties on how they are scoring with instruments, any exceptions they make, any rules they've added?
So I'm hoping I'm not talking out of turn. I have met with my sheriff and the Sheriff's Association, and we are forming a Sheriff's Association group. We're the ones that do the registration. We want to have some influence on what's happening, mainly on we want to standardize what is done across the state. Like I said, we do things this way. If the other 14 counties are going to do them their way. We want to standardize that and try to keep it the same. I hope that we can work parallel with what's going on here to where you guys and us as a board make these assessments, make these rules, and then we as the counties can work to keep it standardized and keep it the same. I can tell you right now, it's not the same. It's not standardized. The assessment is done by opinion on each agency, whether or not they do the assessment.
And then, of course, training is an issue too.
Correct.
With there's no statewide training.
Correct. And I know multiple agencies within my county, a guy will become a detective and expected to do this. And so one day he's working patrol, the next day he's doing an assessment on a sex offender. If there's nothing else.
Very good information for us. Thank you. And I know that, and I know you'll be back next month to do the rest of your presentation.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
Just as long.
I appreciate it. Thank you all. Right before we wrap up, if there's any call, I'm going to call for any future agenda items at this time. And as always, you can also email and staff if you have any
Katie Crutchy, I would suggest there's some other related bills to the ones we decided today or may have opinions on today. I think we should add those as well to the agenda next time. I can give you them now, or maybe, I know if you're feeling for calls about these, if you have an idea of what those bills are. So I think there's multiple other bills that relate to the early termination of probation, and I don't know which ones might make it through or not make it through.
So perhaps we can connect to make sure I have those to get with staff. Okay, thank you.
And then at some point, I would recommend we do something on probation conditions, but I don't know if we'll see for the next meeting.
In what regard probation conditions?
Like what they are, so I think part of our things
as a presentation.
Okay.
Perhaps since we're all night.
Okay. Always have any type of probation conditions. Go ahead, Mr. Neal.
Yes.
I was just going to comment first.
Oh,
we want to bring somebody from juvenile probation to similar.
Okay, thank you. I can see time, and it is 5:06. Thank you all so much, 5:07. I will adjourn this meeting. Thank you all so much for your time and everything tonight. Thank you.
I'm so sorry.
Do I have a second?
Yeah.
All those in favor? Aye.
Okay.
You don't have to read the motion and
who
seconded.
Miss Nikki, you can read the motion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Amanda, seconded.
All
of them.
Yes, I know.
Which one? Yes, I ran out.